Working in solidarity with Indigenous land and water defenders and supporting Indigenous justice is incredibly important. How can the climate movement get over its fear of making mistakes to be a supportive partner?
Welcome to Climate Organizing Shorts, where we're having short but inspiring conversations with climate organizers to help give you ideas for how you can build momentum for change in your community.
Climate Organizing Shorts is a collaboration between Pullback Podcast and the Climate Justice Organizing Hub. I'm Kyla Hewson, and I'm here with Kristen Pugh.
On today's episode, we spoke with Janelle Lapointe. Janelle is an Afro-Indigenous climate justice and Indigenous rights activist from Stellaton First Nation, as well as the Interim Director of Public Engagement and Mobilization at the David Suzuki Foundation.
Janelle provides valuable perspectives on cultivating meaningful and respectful solidarity with Indigenous struggles, emphasizing sustained commitment and inclusion in the broader climate movement. Let's get started.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. Suzy, Janelle Lapointe, Stellaton, Incas, Luxoyu, Asli, Alu, Michelle Lapointe, Abba, Renee Lapointe, Atsu, Emma Baker, Etsien, Willie Baker. Hi, my name is Janelle Lapointe. I'm from Stellaton First Nation, which is located in the northern interior of so-called BC. I'm Caribou clan, and yeah, as part of protocol in my language, we introduce our parents and our matrilineal grandparents. So my grandmother, Emma Baker, is a Dakath elder, and my late grandfather, Willie Baker, was a Black man from the United States, part Choctaw. So yeah, those are my relations. And yeah, I've been in the climate justice space for about 5 years. I work at the David Suzuki Foundation in public engagement and mobilization. I organize with a grassroots group called Common Horizon, whose goal is to kind of bridge climate justice and economic justice and win real climate solutions that also make lives better for everyday people. And yeah, I wear a bunch of other hats in the climate space, but I always say it's more important who I am than what I do. So my work is really grounded in being a Stellaton woman, a young person from that nation, and really consider this work as part of my birthright as being from those territories and stewarding those lands. I think that the climate movement is going through a bit of a reckoning, and I really see the youth climate movement really leading in the space of deepening the understanding on what actually causes the climate crisis and communicating the root causes of the climate crisis as being imperialism, colonialism, and capitalism. And I think the more climate advocates can deepen the understanding of that, the more that Indigenous worldviews and frameworks make sense, and the more that we can see our struggles interconnected, whether you're Indigenous or non-Indigenous. The important thing to know is Indigenous people, their laws, their governance structures, their language, and their culture are all really tied to the lands that they've stewarded. Indigenous people in this country on Turtle Island are the only people that have been able to live on these lands sustainably since time immemorial. And they did that by really seeing the world around them, their human and non-human relations as kin. And so the underpinning of all Indigenous frameworks and knowledge system is that. And in my community, you know, we are from, like I said, the northern tier part of so-called British Columbia, which if anyone has been, it's an area that really experiences all four seasons. There's long, harsh winters, hot, busy summers, and we are a nomadic people. So the people really had to move around the territory, learn where they should be at what time zone. So really had to pay close attention to where they can survive and what time, which I think nomadic people, yeah, really have a relationship with a vast amount of territory. And our leaders, our hereditary system, you were considered a good leader if your land was plentiful and if people had not only enough for themselves, but enough to share with other clans when we came together in our governance structure. And so, yeah, I think the underpinning of those systems are, yeah, that connection to the land, but also caring for each other and a sense of abundance. And I think sometimes the mainstream climate movement is moving with the opposite. They're moving with urgency and scarcity that is actually preventing them from doing the deep learning that they need to do to be able to understand these frameworks.
So what are some of the pieces that you think sort of the mainstream climate movement is missing in terms of that deep learning? And how can we sort of pivot?
Someone explained it to me once of like, just talking about urgency. I think the climate movement operates in urgency. And someone was telling me, like, we all know what urgency feels like, and it doesn't feel good. So the person was describing it to me as, you know what it feels like to have to pack a bag last minute, and how it feels like head to toe, stressful and bad, and how you often forget important things when you're in that state. And I think that's what the climate movement is doing. We're operating in a way which is not only damaging to the collective movement, but really hard on our individual nervous systems and well-being. And it makes it hard to see the important things in front of us when we're operating in that state. So the big thing I think the climate movement is missing is like the sense of that we're in a long-term struggle. And yes, the climate impacts are here and now, are worsening, and every day, every degree that we can lower globally really does matter, but that we come from a long line of resistance, a long line of movement keepers, and that there's going to be a lot of that work happening when we're gone. And so that we do have time to slow down, and we actually owe it to the people that came before us and the people that will come after us to slow down and make sure that we're not forgetting important things. And I think the big thing the climate movement is missing is understanding what Indigenous sovereignty looks like, understanding anti-racism, and understanding class solidarity. Because if you really truly can understand that the root causes of climate change is imperialism and capitalism and colonialism, then you'll also understand that racism, classism, and all the awful isms and injustices that are happening right now are interconnected with each other, and that the only way we can create a movement powerful enough is to connect ourselves with other movements for change and always orientate ourselves to the margins of the people that are experiencing the climate crisis, like Indigenous people.
What are some of the best ways that maybe climate organizers who aren't coming from Indigenous backgrounds can sort of start to take steps to incorporate solidarity, not only with Indigenous reconciliation, but also with sort of other kinds of justice causes that you're mentioning?
Yeah, I think even just like, you know, taking your activist hat off and without thinking about the goal of climate justice, we still, as people, as settlers or uninvited guests on these lands, like have a responsibility to figure out what a good reciprocal relationship looks like with the nations whose land we're on. If you really love the place you live, and we all want places that are safe, places that are abundant, places that are safe for our children and future generations, then yeah, we would turn to the people who had the governance systems, the community models, the family models that live that on these lands, and yeah, see the benefits, the mutual benefits of being in good relationships. So I think even just people, you know, often get in their own way with building relationships with Indigenous people because there's ego involved, there's fear involved, they're worried about saying the wrong thing, doing the wrong thing. But I think Indigenous people are really open to just, you know, having non-Indigenous people come to their community events, you know, listening to the elders, giving youth opportunities. And the more that you can build a relationship that's reciprocal, the more figuring out what climate justice looks like by falling into the struggles, it doesn't become a big scary project because you're working with friends and allies that you have a relationship with.
I'm wondering, like, in terms of building those relationships, do you have any tips for sort of what is a good and responsible and like helpful way to go about it versus like maybe some stuff to avoid?
Yeah, I want to exclamation double underline reciprocity. I think that's the biggest thing, is like you don't need to go to a community looking to extract certain types of knowledge or ways of knowing, or even going to them asking how to solve the climate crisis. Like going there in good faith and wanting to be a good friend. And hopefully we all know what a good friend looks like. And I think those are the same kind of attitudes and approaches that you can take to building relationships with the community, thinking about what kind of skills and knowledge and resources you have to offer to a community instead of, you know, often looking to Indigenous communities for their skills and resources. My grandmother tells a really powerful story about when our communities first heard settlers were coming to the area. So because we're in the North Center interior, of course, colonization happened further east and further south of us. And we had communications with other communities. So she tells a story about, you know, word getting to our nations that settlers were coming and the communities having a decision-making process on how are they were going to deal with the newcomers. And she says that people were trying to decide whether to fight the newcomers off or welcome them in. Because at that time, we had, of course, huge numbers, way more higher populations than we have today. And of course, the knowledge of the land that honestly fighting off settlers at the time would have been possible. But the decision was made to invite newcomers in because that's how we worked with different nations and different peoples. We invited them in and saw what we can do for one another. And that's, I think, still the spirit and the invitation that's open today. The invitation is not for us to save you or you to save us. It's to see what we can do for one another. And so I think that's the sentiment that needs to be brought forward. But also knowing that you might do the wrong thing and you might make mistakes and you might get teased or poked fun at and it's not the end of the world. It's okay to make mistakes. And as long as you go in with a good heart, I'm sure you'll be given the opportunity to reparate, which is also something I think we need to learn how to do in this new context, is how to make mistakes but have a chance to do better.
I'm wondering, just because you've been in so many climate justice spaces, do you have any sort of examples that come to mind of Indigenous solidarity done really well, or like positive experiences that you've had, or negative ones if that sticks out as well?
Yeah, the negative experiences, I think, often come from fear and ego getting in the way to where we do nothing. And one of my biggest gripes right now is knowing that the climate movement and the well-resourced organizations that are a part of it are really fearful of making mistakes. So their tendency is to do nothing or do things that are really light touch, or, you know, they use the language of waiting for Indigenous people to lead. But the people that are not waiting for that are the oil companies, are right-wing politicians that are in our communities constantly. And they're the ones that are building relationships. And yes, it's done because money's on the table and it's done in an extractive way. But I feel really, really sad that corporations are doing a better job at relationship building just because they're not letting the fear of making a mistake getting in their way. And I'm not saying the climate movement should replicate the model that corporations use, but certainly they can take the first step of building relationships and not letting the fear of making mistakes or getting called out get in the way. I had the opportunity to collaborate on the Wilderness Committee's Indigenous peoples approach, and they use the language of being a good friend, and their principles are on being a good friend, showing up when we have capacity, not being afraid of making mistakes. And yeah, they're an organization that I think is doing their best and trying to do relationship building in a good way. Yeah, they're an organization that's mostly focused on conservation, and conservation has deep roots of white supremacy and wanting to separate Indigenous people from the land and loving trees more than they care about Indigenous people. And so I'm like really heartened to see an organization like them take a new approach, which I think is the right one.
Let's maybe talk about like moments for showing solidarity, because I know in 2019, like the Wet'suwet'en blockades were sort of one example of that. But I'm wondering, like, when it comes to climate justice organizers that are wanting to sort of show up for Indigenous land defending and water protecting struggles, what is the best way to do that? And how do you sort of, for somebody that's maybe never done that before, what are some of the first steps, do you think?
You know, one thing I really noticed about the difference of how I was raised in my culture and Western culture is, like, I was taught for so long to just, like, show up and listen. And me showing up in a space and being quiet and just listening is not seen as like not being productive or not paying attention. It, like witnessing work is really big in a lot of Indigenous cultures. And I think when people show up and are quiet enough to hear what important words are being spoken, that direction will come. So when there's a frontline resistance, you will often hear from the leaders, the elders, the hereditary chiefs of the nation, exactly what they're asking settlers to do. And I think it's really important that people just sit within those bounds and follow that direction. If you have ideas or approaches, if you have built a good relationship with the nation, then those are welcome to be brought forward. But I think just knowing your role, doing the work of building that reciprocal relationship before you go in and try to dictate the action is really important. But, you know, the climate movement waiting until there is a big moment, like waiting until Indigenous people are up against a corporation, well, there's RCMP brought in, until there's literally snipers on Indigenous people before we are moved to action and moved to be in relationship with that nation is quite shameful. And we often think about how the way corporations, their consultation process from communities as extractive. I think the climate movement's reactive approach to showing up for Indigenous struggles is also extractive, because it's saying, we're not willing to show up or make a relationship until people's bodies and well-being and livelihoods are really on the line. And if that's our approach, it's a losing strategy, because we can't expect these nations to have the capacity, the resources to do that all the time. And when we do, it's a huge, huge sacrifice from these people. And even when we do show up at that moment, our risk as outsiders is, you know, kind of drops in the bucket compared to what's being already put on the line. So I really want to, you know, encourage people, of course, to answer those calls to actions and show up to frontline resistance. But I think now is a critical moment to really think about how we are building those relationships proactively and being in good relationship before there's even a struggle such as what happened in Wet'suwet'en. Yeah, what would that look like, and how we can inoculate ourselves against the strategy that oil corporations are doing? You know, they have often paid full-time salaried people whose only job is to build relationships with Indigenous people. And so if we're letting that happen in the background and only showing up when there's police violence or guns involved, I think it's doing a really real disservice to the nations and to our movement's chance of winning.
Yeah, I'm curious what you think, like, what should that look like for a local climate justice organization? Should there be like one person who is responsible for making sure they're always sort of seeking relationships with the communities that are around them, or something else? I don't know.
I think it needs to be done with intention, but it doesn't always have to be formalized. Like, we don't need to all become organizations that have Indigenous relationship people just because that's what the corporations are doing. But I think being in good communication with the nations you're on about, you know, what your organization's goals and plans are, asking if the work that you want to do, your vision of climate justice, is in line with their vision of climate justice is a good start. And yeah, I also think one of the missed opportunities is, yeah, we're expecting Indigenous nations to put their bodies on the line when they've been surviving over 150 years of colonization. And these nations, you know, have basically been systemically impoverished by being separated from the Canadian economy. And my foresight is telling me that the next phase of the government's game is now what they're calling economic reconciliation, where they're saying, actually, us giving the opportunity for a nation to buy into a pipeline or a resource project is doing reconciliation better than the government, because we're the only ones that are addressing the poverty now. And of course, that narrative is just like, you know, the next phase of them excluding. I feel like they waited until there was enough public awareness about Indigenous sovereignty and following the lead of Indigenous people, and are now quickly flipping the coin so that they can say to leftist movements or the climate movement, hey, if you really stand behind what you said about respecting Indigenous people's decision-making, then you're going to support this pipeline because they support this pipeline. And so in order to underpin that, the climate movement needs like a strong vision of what climate solutions look like in the community, what economic alternatives look like in communities. And I think above that, as part of our climate justice work, we should really be calling out the amount of dollars that the Canadian government has made off Indigenous lands and calling for a cash back approach, not just land back, a cash back approach that is reparating these nations so that they're on an even playing field with the rest of the community and can actually say yes or no without the kind of coercion that kind of colonial state manufactured poverty has put them in.
I think that's a really important point. There are two things that you mentioned that I think maybe listeners might not know as much about. So I wonder if you could talk first of all about what land back means, and then secondly, cash back, what that means.
It's really amazing. Like we have, you know, well over 100 sovereign nations coast to coast to coast in so-called Canada. And, you know, we often talk in the climate movement about Indigenous knowledge, but it's more than just like knowledge and ways of being. Like all of these nations had governance structures that were really sophisticated. And like I said, allowed them to be the only people on this land that have been able to use it sustainably, live on it sustainably. So, you know, land back is a movement to return those lands to Indigenous people so that they can, you know, reenact those governance structure in a contemporary way and to manage their own lands, laws, and resources. And I know settlers sometimes immediately feel their walls up around that because they wonder how they fit into the picture. And so I want to like really bring it back to the story I told of a lot of Indigenous nations sentiment of and settlers arriving on their nations was to see what we can do for one another. And so land back is not about kicking settlers out. It's about finding a way to coexist on these lands by leaning on the governance structures that have made them the only people that have survived for millennia, because hopefully all of us on these lands also have that goal in mind of being able to live in a better way on these lands. And so, yeah, land back is exactly what it sounds like, but it looks a little bit different nation to nation. I'm from a territory that was unceded, no treaties were ever signed. And so there's a myth that land is now crown land owed to the government and it should simply be just simply returned to the Indigenous nations. But on other lands where treaties are signed, I think it also means on upholding the original agreements of those lands that were made with settlers. Yeah, I think another way that settlers can show up for Indigenous people is learning about what those agreements look like. If you're from a treaty nation, learning about what those treaties said, how they came to be, and ways that you can actually live according to them as guests on those lands. And then, yeah, cash back is, and Indigenous people have been subjected to living under the Indian Act, which completely excluded them from the Canadian economy. So Indigenous people weren't allowed to vote, often weren't hired. I think a lot of people don't even realize the history of Canada. Like Indigenous people weren't allowed in businesses, restaurants, bars until the late 60s. My grandmother says that when she was in Vancouver, she used to borrow her Chinese friend's ID to be able to go out to restaurants. So that's like super recent memory. It's just a generation before mine. And during this time is also when a lot of resource extraction projects went up. So Indigenous people were systemically put onto reserves. They weren't allowed to leave without permission of an Indian agent, weren't allowed to vote. And all the money that was made off the extraction of the lands went straight to the Canadian government and has been held in a trust fund, which has made billions and billions of dollars. And that has been withheld from Indigenous communities, making them, you know, dependent on the federal government to be able to hand back small pockets of the money that was made off their lands time after time. And this Indian Trust Fund has, the government has taken from it to build highways and hospitals, basically just spend according to however they think it should be spent. That wealth is there and exists. And so the government is definitely capable of reparating it because they were capable of systemically hoarding it. And so, yeah, I would encourage people to learn more about that trust fund. The Yellowhead Institute a few years ago released a report called the Cashback Report, which talks about the history of that process and what cash reparations could look like. I also love Reconciliation Manifesto by Arthur Emanuel that also, yeah, talks about this process in ways that that money could be returned. Yeah, there's just been so much good work done so that land back and cash back doesn't need to be theoretical. There's a lot of labor that's already been done with Indigenous people telling us exactly what that could look like. And so people just need to look up those resources and learn.
Are there any projects that you're working on or campaigns that you're working on giving you energy or making you feel excited or anything that you want to shout out before we say goodbye?
Yeah, I just want to keep plugging Common Horizon because we are just starting and we're going to be starting our campaign to hopefully win a windfall tax and wealth tax on those billionaires. And we're going to have our first day of action coming up this spring. And so we are Common Horizon Commune on Instagram, and we'd love for folks to follow and check it out. And maybe we will be building in a chapter in a city near you shortly.
If you want to learn more about Indigenous justice, check out the amazing research from the Yellowhead Institute, including their red papers on land back and cash back.
And if you want to learn more about the Climate Justice Organizing Hub and the work that they do, check out their wiki, which provides information and resources for activists in the climate justice movement.
The wiki is an excellent tool for information on all sorts of topics related to climate justice, like accessibility, burnout and care, movement structure, recruitment and retention, student organizing, and more. You can find a link to the wiki in the show notes or visit lehub.ca.